this book, chapters 2 and 3, that contains little brief letters to each of the seven congregations that Revelation is addressed to. We looked at the letter to the church at Ephesus on Sunday morning. We're going to look at two of them tonight. I had to do that to kind of compress things and make this quarter's lessons fit the schedule. So we're going to look at two of those letters, the letter to the church at Smyrna that begins in chapter 2 in verse 8, and then the letter to the church at Pergamum, or some translations have Pergamus, that starts in verse 12. And the first thing I ask you to do on all of these lessons about these churches is tell me a little bit about the environment that these churches were existing in. So first of all, talk about Smyrna for a minute. Find anything really exciting about the city of Smyrna in your studies for this lesson. Will?
It was considered the major port of Asia.
Okay.
The Aegean Sea.
Okay. All right. Very good. Very good. Anybody else? Shane. Okay. All right. Anybody else? If you go to the site, and we're talking about Smyrna, if you're looking at our map, which, yeah, there's our map. We started in Ephesus. Smyrna is right here, just about 40 miles up the coast, and it is like Ephesus. It's an important seaport on the Aegean coast. This is now the site of the city of Izmir, which kind of carries over the Smyrna name, Izmir, Turkey. If you go there today, you don't see a whole lot in terms of the ruins of Smyrna. You see things like this. You see, there's the remains of the Agora of Smyrna, and then you've got all these nice modern buildings in the background. There are other cities in Asia Minor with much more impressive ruins than the ones at Smyrna. We're going to talk about that as we go along. From a distance, the buildings on the Acropolis. We're going to talk about the Acropolis of some of these towns. That's the highest point. And up on the nearest hillside, it's where most of the temples would be located. And you know, you wanted the stuff that really stood out there because people could see that from a distance when they were approaching your town. It's kind of a community pride sort of thing, and among other things. The Acropolis of Smyrna resembled a crown the way its buildings were arranged. And so Crown of Asia was kind of a nickname that it was given, and that just kind of stuck. Important commercial center, being a seaport, much like Ephesus was. Big cultural heritage. Smyrna was one of about half a dozen cities in Asia that claimed to be the birthplace of the poet Homer. Like a lot of other celebrities, nobody knew for sure, so everybody said, yeah, he was born here. Smyrna did that, so they had a lot of... It probably, you could come and say Homer slept here, and they'd give you the tour. I don't know what all they did in the first century. Long history of loyalty to Rome, politically and religiously. A lot of temples and shrines to various deities, as you might imagine. Remember, I mean, any of these places that you were to go, that's what you would find. In AD 26, and this is right about the time that Jesus is beginning his ministry, Smyrna was chosen over 10 other cities in Asia as the site for a temple to the emperor Tiberius. Remember we talked about the fact that a lot of these emperors, especially about the time they died, if they had done a good job and won the favor of the people and the Senate, they would be deified. They would be declared among the gods after they died, and you might have a temple built in their honor somewhere. And Sardis was chosen for the temple to the emperor Tiberius. There's another inscription found at Smyrna in a temple dedicated to Nero, hailing him as the savior of the whole human race. This is why this kind of language applied to Jesus rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. You only talked about dead emperors with that kind of language as far as a lot of people were concerned. So by the time John writes to the church at Smyrna, it, among other places in Asia Minor, is one of those strongholds of not just ordinary paganism, but particularly emperor worship. And we talked on Sunday, if Revelation is indeed written in the last decade of the first century, when Domitian is the emperor, we talked about the evidence that Domitian seems to be the first emperor who wanted to be deified while he was still alive. And so the cult of emperor worship in general was very, very active during his administration, particularly in Asia Minor, and seemingly particularly in places like Smyrna. We've got some. You do have a few nice ruins that you can go and see. This is some archways that have been preserved from the agora at Smyrna. Not a whole lot else that I could find really good shots of. Will mentioned that at Smyrna, the Christians are facing opposition from two sources. They're facing opposition, first of all, from the persecuting Roman authorities, because they will not indulge in emperor worship and the other kinds of paganism. Who else is it they're facing opposition from? Okay. All right. So here's what Jesus says to them. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. So it seems that the local Jewish community in Smyrna was very fiercely opposed to these Christians. That comports with some of the evidence that we have from certain historical sources in the 2nd century and 3rd century, some writings about the Jewish community there. And please don't think this was characteristic of Jews all over the empire, but it seems that at Smyrna, at least a large contingent of the Jewish population had kind of compromised on the whole giving the appearance of emperor worship. Anyway, we'll just go through the motions even though we don't mean it. And the followers of Christ just couldn't go along with that. There is a story about an early Christian in the 2nd century named Polycarp. He was supposedly a disciple of the Apostle John in his older years, supposedly converted by him. Polycarp lived at Smyrna. And in the middle of the 2nd century, Polycarp was condemned as a Christian during a wave of persecution and was condemned to be burned at the stake. And the story goes that the local Jewish population in Smyrna were yelling their condemnations at him, and despite the fact that it was a Sabbath day on which he was executed, many of those Jews were happy to help gather wood for the fire on which he was burned. Now, that's a story, and I don't know how much credibility we need to attach to all the details of it. But it comports with exactly what Jesus says in this letter about the hostility of the Jews at Smyrna toward the Christians there. And so, as a result of that, you notice what Jesus says about these Jews in verse 9. What does he say about them? All right. He says they're a synagogue of Satan. He says they're not Jews. That's the kind of language Paul would use in the book of Romans, for instance. The people who are really Jews, in the truest sense of the word, are those who accept Christ. He says these people aren't Israel. They're a synagogue of Satan. And he acknowledges that the Christians at Smyrna have endured blasphemy from these people. They have endured opposition from these people. So Jesus says, I know your tribulation, I know your poverty, but he says, you are rich. There's going to be another one of these congregations where practically the opposite is said. Another one of these seven congregations lives in a wealthy environment and seems to think that they have need of nothing, and Jesus said, you, it says, and I'm paraphrasing, you don't know how poor you are. That's the flip side of the church at Smyrna. They don't have much in terms of material things, but he says they're rich. So in what sense do you think they're rich? Okay. It's got to mean spiritually that they are rich. This is one of only two of these seven congregations about which Jesus doesn't offer any criticism. That everything he says about them is commending them. But they are in a difficult situation. They live in an environment where they are being persecuted by all the culture around them. The Jews are persecuting them. Those who are not Jews but are loyal to Rome can't understand why these weird Christians won't at least go through the motions of offering a pinch of incense on the altar to the emperor, like everybody else. You know, these antisocial, atheistic people, that's the kinds of words that were used of the Christians. We already talked last week about how that kind of suspicion and fear of Christians is what fed into, what fed waves of persecution, like the one that Nero started in Rome, and evidently the one that is going on during the reign of Domitian in the last part of the first century. In verse 10, he tells them not to be afraid of what they are about to suffer. What does he say is about to happen? All right. He says, do not fear the things you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison. Why? All right. So that you will be tested. And you will have tribulation for how long, he says? Okay. Now, just on the surface of it, Satan's going to see to it that some of you are thrown into jail for 10 days. That doesn't sound so bad, does it? I mean, jail's not a nice place, but 10 days. What did we say when we started talking about Revelation at the very beginning? What did we say about the numbers we encounter in this book? Okay. Most of the time, when you run across a number in Revelation, it has some kind of symbolic intent. Do you think Jesus is warning the Christians at Smyrna that a handful of them are going to do 10 days in jail? Is that, that calls for him to say, don't be afraid? That number 10, very much like the number 7 in Revelation, that number 10 conveys wholeness or completeness, and in terms of time, it conveys a full period of time. Jesus can hardly mean a literal 10 days. He's saying for a period of time that is not insignificant, you are going to be tested. Now, do you think it's possible some of them might get literally thrown in prison? Sure. Okay, that kind of thing, as we've already seen, that kind of thing is happening to Christians in Asia Minor. We're going to see other things happening to them as well. Some of them we might consider not quite as bad as being thrown in prison. Some of them we might consider worse. Economic hardship, that is, boycotts and things like that are targeted at them because they are Christians. They have a hard time buying and selling. Some of them are going to be put to death for this. Jesus is going to be very clear in encouraging them about that in the book of Revelation. It's in that context, we often quote from the very last part of Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. What does Jesus say to them in the last sentence in verse 10? Okay. All right. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. The wording there does not just mean be faithful until the day you die, all your live long life. It's more than that. Really, the idea is be faithful even to the point of death. Be faithful even if death is the price for being faithful. And that helps us understand that the imprisonment he's talking about is a portrait of their suffering, their being persecuted. They might die for their profession of Christ. He says, if you will be faithful even up to that point, what does he say I will give you? I will give you a crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. We didn't get a chance to talk about this on Sunday, but I'm going to mention something. I'm going to let Ural make a point. Go ahead. Yeah, I believe that's right. Yeah, that's another one of those very well attested, uninspired sources. Yeah, it says when Polycarp was to be executed, or when he was being tried, it was demanded that he renounce his faith in Christ. Polycarp was an old man, and here they're about to execute this old man for the crime of being a Christian. And Polycarp was reported to it. Now this is 70 years after Revelation is written. But it's exactly the kind of thing that Revelation is written to prepare disciples for. And Polycarp says, 86 years I have served him, and he has never done me any wrong. How could I deny him now? Words to that effect. That's right. Okay. Exactly the kind of courage, even in the face of death, that Jesus is encouraging these Christians at that very place, Smyrna, to have. That lets us know that what the Lord is preparing them for really does come to pass. It's the environment in which they live. Mike?
I think they are facing death, and I think that's why he introduces himself as he does, as the one who is dead and has come to life, as a reminder that there's something beyond death. You know, they can kill him, but there's a hope and a reward beyond that. He's proof of that.
Didn't take time to talk about this on Sunday, but in each of these letters, there's a motif that carries over through all seven of them. And it is this. At the beginning of the letter, Jesus identifies himself. For example, in Ephesus, the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks among the seven golden lampstands. Or in verse 8 to the church at Smyrna, the first and the last who was dead and has come to life says this. Verse 12 to Pergamum, the one who has the sharp two-edged sword says this. You see what he's doing? He's introducing himself using imagery from what John described back in chapter 1 when he saw the one like a son of man, when he saw Jesus. He's just grabbing pieces of those pictures, pieces of that picture of himself, and using them to introduce himself as he starts this letter. And then at the end of each letter, you have two things. Number one, he says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Remember, we made the observation Sunday that all of these letters, even though they are addressed to individual congregations, they get to be read by all seven of these groups. So, not just the church at Ephesus, but the other six churches in Asia get to read about what's going on at Ephesus, the good and the bad. Not just the Christians at Smyrna, but the other six congregations in Asia get to read about their tribulation, the hostility of the Jews there, the fact that they are about to go through an even greater period of suffering than they are enduring now. And there is an appeal at the end of each of these letters for anyone who is willing to listen. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Jesus would sometimes say that at the end of a parable. To pay attention to the messages that are given to each of these churches, because there's something to learn from them. Well, that's why we're studying them. That's why we're talking about them as we are tonight. And then the other thing that's characteristic of the end of each of these letters is a promise to the one who overcomes, a promise of blessing. And very often it's couched in highly symbolic kinds of language, but for example, to Ephesus it was, to him who overcomes I will grant to eat of the tree of life which is in the paradise of God. Well, that harkens all the way back to the book of Genesis. The thing that was lost in Genesis chapter 3 when Adam and Eve sinned was access to the tree of life, access to immortality and perfect fellowship with God. Jesus says, that's what I'm offering you. But what have they got to do to get it? Okay. That word overcome is the condition in all of these things, and that's being faithful unto death. Revelation is all about overcoming. Watch for that word because it comes up a lot, not just in chapters 2 and 3, but all through this book. John will see certain people. Who are those people? Those are the people that have overcome. Oh. That's where the condition of the promised reward. So to Smyrna in verse 11, he says, "He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death." John's going to talk later on about the second death. We may be familiar with that today. What does he mean when he says the second death? Okay, yeah, yeah. It's what one preacher called essential death. It is death not just physically, but death in the sense of eternal separation from God. Yeah. Cast into the lake of fire is how the end of Revelation will describe it. Eternal condemnation. And he says, if you overcome, you won't be hurt by that. You escape that. This is why we said one of the key messages of Revelation is simply to tell these Christians there are a lot worse things than having to die for your faith in Christ. In fact, if you die for your faith, you win. You overcome. You are victorious. So watch for those common themes in all seven of these letters. An introduction that borrows from the picture in chapter 1 and the admonition to hear and the encouragement, he who overcomes will be blessed. And that's a running theme in all seven of these letters. Anything else before we talk about the letter to the church at Pergamum? Yes, sir.
Just as a connection, I know a lot of what I've read about with the way the Christians were treated in this period of time and the period of time going forward, very, very similar to what I read about with the Holocaust and the Jews. Incredibly similar treatment.
Yeah, yeah, you do. That there, in a lot of ways, if you want a modern parallel, and it's not... You know, it's not analogous in every conceivable way, but yes, if you want to get an idea of what that was like in more recent history, that's where you would have to go, is to think about the Holocaust. Yeah. Let's talk about the letter to the church at Pergamum. What do you know about the city of Pergamum? What were you able to find out? Will? Okay, that's good. All right. Pergamum, have a little better, and here's Pergamum, another 40 miles or so to the north of Smyrna, so about 80 miles almost due north of Ephesus. So what you can see is these letters are going kind of in a circle clockwise. This is an aerial shot of the ruins of Pergamum as they are today, and it is. It's built on a very tall hillside. You can probably make out an amphitheater, kind of the lower right, and the Acropolis up above that. Pretty good remains to the left. There were also a pretty good number of structures that would be off to the right that you can't really see much remains of today. And here's another shot of that theater. Like Ephesus, a very large theater. I think the one at Ephesus held something like 25,000 people, which is huge for an ancient theater. This one held about 20,000, so it's pretty close to that. Pergamum actually was the capital of the province of Asia for most of the New Testament era. It is also the center for the Roman state religion of emperor worship. There were a lot of that at Smyrna. There was even more of that at Pergamum. We'll talk about that in a minute. Pergamum was the place supposedly where parchment was first used. That's writing. That's using dried animal skins as a writing surface, as paper. In fact, the Greek word that's translated parchment basically means paper of Pergamum. So it's got that going for it. Will mentioned the worship of the god Asclepius, who was the god of medicine. And there was a big medical center at Pergamum. In fact, here's a fun fact for you. Have you ever wondered why a lot of medical facilities have a snake wrapped around a pole as a symbol? Pergamum is why. the cult of Asclepius. Asclepius was worshipped under the image of a snake, which is a weird thing to worship for healing, I know, but you know, it's paganism. But that's kind of, that cultus is where that imagery comes from. Is that some dim memory of the bronze serpent that Moses erected in the wilderness? I don't know. It'd be hard to tell about that. Here's something else, though, that is very important at Pergamum. This is a model of what the Acropolis of Pergamum probably would have looked like in the first century. This is from a museum in Berlin. And I'm telling you about that for a reason. But you can see the theater kind of in the middle left there. Up above it to the left, you can see a temple that was, I think that was a temple to Hadrian, so that one wouldn't have actually been there yet in the New Testament era, because Hadrian had not become emperor yet. But it looked roughly like this. But right in the middle, just to the right, there is a temple, looks like this. And that is an altar to Zeus, who was, or Jupiter if you were a Roman, who was the king of the pagan gods. And this thing was immense. This is a model of it from that museum in Berlin. This is actually a reconstruction of it using some of the friezes from the original, some of the carvings from the original that were brought to Berlin in the late 19th century. And you can see sort of how big it was, and this is only really a partial reproduction of it. Just to go back, you can see what a prominent place it occupied on the Acropolis. How much attention it would have gotten. And verse 13, how does Jesus in verse 13 describe where these people dwelled? All right, the place where Satan's throne is. Some commentators have made the observation, hey, this temple to Zeus kind of shaped like a throne. Maybe that's what Jesus meant. I'm not sure Jesus meant anything quite so literal as that. But just the sheer number of pagan temples, including temples to various emperors that were located in Pergamum, the fact that it was the capital of Asia and the very heart of pagan worship, including emperor worship in the province, I think is probably what makes it the place where Satan's throne was. But a lot of people can't help but observe that this is a great example of that. Architecturally speaking, if you want to go to Berlin and see this, you still can. I think it's actually closed for long-term cleaning and reconstruction right now. It's supposed to open in a year or two. But this is the kind of thing that was characteristic of Pergamum. So this is what Jesus says to these people: "I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is." Now you imagine getting a letter that is written by John, but it is from the mouth of Jesus Christ saying, "I know that you live where Satan has his throne. I know you are in a place that is the very heart of evil in this world." That's a powerful statement for Jesus to say that about the Christians at Pergamum. What else in verse 13, what does he say these people, how have they responded to their environment? Okay, they remained true to his name. They what?
They held fast.
All right. They held fast. He says, "You have held fast my name and did not deny my faith. Even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells." How many of your translations of verse 13, instead of witness, have the word martyr? Faithful martyr. Okay. That's because the Greek word martyr, means witness. And it is from this language right here that we have come to apply the term martyr to someone who dies for their faith. Because Antipas, Jesus' faithful witness at Pergamum, died for that witness. He died because he held fast to the testimony of Jesus. He said, you have all held fast to it. All right? James? Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Ooh, yeah, yeah. The tradition, and again, uninspired tradition, always take it with at least a grain or two of salt. But the uninspired tradition is that the way Antipas died was he was placed inside a statue of a bull, which was typically the image under which Zeus would have been worshipped, and roasted alive inside that thing. People did really awful things sometimes to Christians just because of what we believed. That's it. So that's the kind of environment that Pergamum is. And Jesus praises the church there because they have held fast to him even during times when at least one of them, Antipas, whom Jesus mentions as if everybody would know who he's talking about, were put to death for that. And in light of all that, what Jesus says next is kind of stunning. You would think a bunch of people who were willing to die for their faith, or traditionally, historically, had been willing to even die for their faith, would be rock solid. But he says, unfortunately, I have this against you. I have a few things against you. What does he say needs to change? What is wrong with the church at Pergamum?
Keeping the teachings
of Balaam. Okay. Who was Balaam? Close. No, not even close, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, what, Balak?
Okay, all right.
I thought Balak was the prophet of Balaam.
Balak was the king of Moab who hired Balaam. I know, these names, why didn't these guys have names that are a little more different so we could tell them apart, right? Yeah. When the people of Israel were on their way to the promised land, the king of Moab, Balak, was nervous about them passing through his territory, passing nearby, threatened by them. So he hired Balaam the prophet to curse the people of Israel. Remember the story about Balaam's on his way and yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, Balaam's riding the donkey and the donkey starts talking to him. Okay, the angel's speaking and all that. Remember that story. Great story. It's one of the favorite one of my kids' favorite stories growing up. And then when Balaam actually arrived and opened his mouth to pronounce curses on Israel, God put a blessing in his mouth and said, "Balak, what are you doing?" Balaam just kept pronouncing blessings. So what does Jesus mean when he says, "I have a few things against you," because there are some who hold to the teaching of Balaam? Balaam, that was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Earl? Right.
And yet he went back to see what God would say more. And God said, "Go on."
Okay.
But you can't say anything but what I've been doing.
Right.
And he kept doing what God said, but trying to find some way to get God to say something different, it seems like.
Okay, yeah. All right. Okay. Balak, yeah.
Uh-huh. Balaam told Balak that eventually the people would, no matter what happened, eventually the people would turn from God. And I guess they devised a plan or whatever to basically get the Moabites to intermarry into the Israelites.
Okay.
Which was the downfall because of which they started worshiping like the Moabites did because of the intermarriage. And I guess I'm assuming that there's still some of this.
Okay, all right. You're really close, yeah. You got most of it, yeah. What Scott's describing, Roger, go ahead.
You get to the incident at Bel Peor.
Yes, okay.
They had a big party, and all the women and Moab invited all the men of
Okay? Yeah. Yeah. It it was what most commentators describe as a pagan fertility cult. Yeah. And so you have pagan idolatry and sexual immorality going hand in hand. And what we find out later, after reading that incident, is that Balaam is the one who gave them the idea to do that. So here's this man who was hired to curse the Israelites, couldn't do it because God prevented him, and he still managed to find a way for to help the king of Balak bring the Israelites to trouble, because there was this great plague that came on the people. It was just a horrible disaster because they had acted so immorally. It was Balaam's idea. That's why Jesus says, you hold to the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit acts of immorality. Okay. Ural?
Peter said, he loved the wages of unrighteousness.
Right. Yeah. He did all this for pay. He did. This is what happens when you prophesy for money. Okay? So in the same way, verse 15, you have some who hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Now we talked about them Sunday. What had the Ephesians done with the Nicolaitans? Yeah. They said, no thank you. He says, you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans. Here at Pergamum, some of the folks there, some of the Christians there, held to their teaching. We talked about, you know, we don't know a great deal about them. In fact, we know next to nothing about the Nicolaitans. Based on this context, they seem to have been a group of people who taught that, you know, going along with the world is really okay. Sexual immorality, a little pagan, you know, a little pagan idolatry here and there, it's all right. Christians can do that. And naturally, you can see the appeal of that. At Thyatira, you're going to have something very similar to that, similar kind of influence. The Ephesians had rejected that. They had exposed it for what it was. At Pergamum, some of the Christians there had embraced it. Well, that needed to change. So Jesus says, therefore repent, or else I am coming to you quickly, and I will make war against them with the sword of my mouth. Judgment is threatened. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, to him I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone and a new name written on the stone which no one knows but he who receives it. A lot of Old Testament imagery in that promise, but it's a promise of blessing. What was the manna about in the Old Testament? Do you remember?
It saved him.
Okay, yeah. It was the food that God miraculously provided for the people out there in the wilderness. Every morning they'd get up, it'd be out there. All they had to do is go collect enough for the day, and they'd have plenty to eat. So there's a promise of sustenance and provision there, and there is a promise of an identity in Christ, of God knowing us, the white stone and the new name written on it. These are all conveying the idea, among other things, that the one who overcomes, God is going to recognize that individual as belonging to Him for eternity. It is something God, is something no power can take away from them. The persecuting Roman authorities can't take it away. The opposition from the Jews at Smyrna can't take it away. Nobody can take it from them. Now, they could forfeit it if they don't overcome. That's why overcoming is the key. That's why it is the condition attached in all seven of these letters to receiving these blessings. All right? Any more thoughts before we finish up tonight?
The two-edged sword represents judgment. The ones who don't overcome get the sword.
Yeah.
And the ones who do get the blessing, they get the manna.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's what's held out. It's like Moses saying to the people of Israel, I set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. Jesus says, I set before you the choice of overcoming and judgment, of everlasting life or the second death. Those are your two choices. There's no middle ground offered. And they are being intensely pressured to choose conformity to the world.
And it's what the rest of the book tells us about.
Right. Right.
When we get to see the picture of good women, we should help us know which side we want to be
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The rest of this book is setting before these Christians, you are on the winning side. You have chosen Christ, and Christ will be victorious. He is, and He always will be. You have no reason not to place your trust in Him. No reason, even if it costs you your life, no reason not to trust Him. And that's where the message will be going from here. All right. Sunday, you're going to be in Roger's capable hands Sunday, because I'm going to be away for a little while. But you're going to be talking about the message to the church at Thyatira on Sunday, and then Sardis and Philadelphia next Wednesday. And we'll continue looking through these letters to these seven churches. Let me ask you this as we close. What do we need to learn from these two letters we just read?
Overcome.
Okay. Well, yeah. All right. Is that it? What? Anything else? Okay. Even if we're not enduring the same level of threats that they are, the pressure on us is to compromise our standards, to compromise so that we can be more comfortable with the world. And Jesus says, don't give in to that pressure. Whatever price you pay for remaining faithful is worth it. That's one of the important lessons from all of these letters, certainly from the ones we've studied tonight. All right, thanks for all your comments and questions tonight.